Kind of a funny name for your paper, because I think the ads are now panned for being like overly dramatic and like, I don't know.
Paranoid.
Yeah, paranoid, heavy-handed. And then I think this paper is maybe a little bit doing the same thing. So like, I don't know, maybe it's great self-awareness.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I was like, I was sure that people thought those brain on drugs ads were so over the top to go around and make people think it's funny, so they wanted to do drugs.
Yeah, and I mean, this is like just say no to ChatGPT. Now all the cool kids will be wearing like ChatGPT t-shirts and like talking to ChatGPT.
So,
well, let me quickly like, can I give like the quick abstract of like what they did?
That would probably help. Yeah.
They had a 4-week session. They recruited a bunch of, they say, adults. It's mostly undergrads and a couple grad students. And over 4 weeks, so week one, you would come in, you would get, you would do some quick cognitive tasks to calibrate an EEG. And then with the EEG headband thingy on, you would then get an SAT essay prompt. So the SAT is like the Leaving Cert in Ireland, or the A levels in the UK, for example. It's like the I want to go to college test. So you get an SAT essay topic on like some abstract concept, like, do you think people can be too eager, or do you think loyalty is needed in order to trust people, or something really abstract like that. And then people were divided into three conditions. They were either in the quote unquote brain only condition. I would contend they also were able to use their body for that condition, but we'll say that they were brain only. There was the search engine condition, so you can both write your essay and also Google stuff, but you can't access, and you can access whatever websites come up from web search, but you can't access any LLMs. And then the LLM condition, where you had access to ChatGPT 4.0, and you didn't have access to anything else on the web, but you could communicate with GPT 4.0 as much as you wanted. And basically they did this over 3 sessions, I think spread a week apart, and compared how people's essays came out in terms of some natural language processing measures. They did some post hoc interviews about like, how do you feel about your essay? Can you quote a line from your essay? What was your approach? That kind of thing. And they also, of course, compared EEG readings across 3 conditions. And then they had a 4th week for people from either the brain or the LLM condition, where they came back and they swapped conditions. So for week 4, brain people had LLM access, and LLM people had brain access. They had that before, presumably, but LLM people only were now able to use their brain and body, but no LLM.
I found that funny as well, the brain only condition. But the more funny thing was that the 4th session was kind of optional. There was only like 18 people in that one, whereas the other 3 sessions appeared to be needed for you to get the $100.
Yeah, it was, if you did the first 3 weeks, you got $100. And if you were in one of those 2 conditions and you elected to come back for this 4th week in the other condition, you could get another $50.
Why not make it all 4 part of the same thing?
There are many study design questions I would like to ask, but this paper was submitted on archive rather than submitted to like a journal where me as a potential peer could review a paper like this.
Yeah, there was a lot of weird design choices. I don't think the format is the usual one. It felt more like a press release, and that they had a lot of content for like the general public. So I feel like they knew what they were doing.
The outcome of this paper is this like MIT Media Lab like webpage about this paper, maybe rather than, you know, strictly scientific outcomes. But yeah, I don't know. This had a few things that I think are pretty prevalent in social sciences right now that I think bother both of us. One is these weird study design choices, and another is the format of like here's this like overhyped kind of a podcast we both listen to is 2 Psychologists, 1 Beer, and they had a guest talking about importance hacking, and this felt a little bit like that it was like, here's some EEG results, this means that you end up owing cognitive debt on if you use LLMs too much, which I don't know if A supports B there.
Yeah, there's one of those things that I also hate about psychology research, where they take a concept, they create a proxy of it by asking people to answer questionnaires and so on, and create this kind of concept that they use as an explanatory variable. And then they go off and get people to do things, and then they say, oh, this explanatory concept explains their behavior. Even though when you actually bring the concept back into the questions that were related to it, it would be questions like, was this machine accurate? And then later on, they'll say, oh, understanding machine accuracy is based on this big concept. And it's like, yeah, of course it is. That's the direct question you ask them.
Laundering in the result, yeah. The original version of like begging the question, it's assuming the answer.
Yeah. But I saw recently as well in that same podcast, they were talking about a study that was looking at the effect of weed on your mind and on your...
Did they call it This Is Your Brain on Drugs?
I think they were a little more self-aware than that. They actually pre-registered that study. And with the initial analysis they had planned from the pre-registering, they found no differences between groups. So groups that used weed frequently, like over 1,000 times, groups that used it infrequently, and groups that didn't use it at all. There was no difference in cognitive measures. There was like working memory and so on. No difference in reported memory and all these things, like their self-reports of their own cognitive measures.
Nice. And did they stop there with a null result in a pre-registered study and publish an awesome paper?
You know where I'm going. So
yeah.
They also had brain scans, and those were also not difference between groups. But what they did was they restructured everything. So it completely didn't align with the pre-registration. Created these weird groups out of the linear variables that they had.
You call it like mega stoners and like...
Exactly, that was literally
it. Oh, jeez.
And they found a difference in brain scans, but still not...
So this is like two of my least favorite things in science. One is this like gerrymandering of results where it's like, if you draw the borders just like this, then you found something. But then also, like, I don't know, I think you and I probably differ in this, but like, how much do you like a brain scan?
I enjoy it in certain aspects, but I've read that paper about how you could get significant differences in brain scans across dead fish. So I'm not one to put most of my eggs in that basket.
I'm like extremely anti-brain scan to the point that like, I sometimes will try to make the argument that the brain isn't even part of cognition for all intents and purposes. Like, yeah, it's there. It's definitely needed. Like, there's definitely stuff happening in there that then leads to cognition. But like, I don't know, there's stuff happening in the heart and the lungs and the liver also. And this isn't my like extreme embodied cognition take. This is like, we're not really good at mapping realist phenomenon, so like the electricy zaps and the waves and whatnot going on in the brain to constructivist concepts like cognition and memory and blah 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 blah, the things we're actually trying to normally study in psychology.
Yeah, it's the ultimate proxy of a proxy. Like, we created the concept of memory and we're trying to describe it with this weird proxy of brain scans that are like third removed from the actual concept.
Yeah, what's the simulacrum, where it's like so far removed now that we've almost lost track of like, wait, we're only doing these brain scans not because we're actually interested in like theta waves, but because we're interested in like creative thinking. But now why are we talking about theta waves when we can do different sorts of analysis to more directly look at creative thinking? Like, we made up creative thinking, bro.
Yeah, I see a lot in the job space, the job market, where people will use personality questions because they want to find people that are conscientious or not neurotic or things like that, because those things correlate with positive job behaviors like going in on time and so on. So then we have this proxy that's like 30% correlation with the things we want to measure. And it's just like, why don't you measure the things directly?
Yeah. If you know what your concept is, why are you using these other, why are you going the long way around? And I think part of it is the old, you know, physics envy and like always wanting to reduce your constructivist concepts down to realist phenomenon, which I think is misguided at best. But yeah, I also think it's like the same reason you're gerrymandering your results, that if you just talk about concepts, the journal editor and the journal reviewers who are trained in this same kind of milieu of papers is going to say, oh, but why didn't you look at something more realist, like, I don't know, brain scans? Or why didn't you slice it up this other way to see if there was a significant difference here? That I think there's so many poorly trained psychologists and social scientists that it's like now a self-perpetuating thing, that if you don't do things the wrong way, you're doing things, if you don't do things in like a maybe not so scientifically rigorous way, then if it's still breaking with the norms of your field, well, you have to go less rigorous and be more like the norm.
I love that term, gerrymandering your results.
I hadn't thought of it like that until you were describing what you were describing, and I was like, I could kind of like imagine a scatter plot where it's like, you know, there's three really clear groups and you're like, no, not those groups that I told you about, actually, like this.
And do you think that's the problem with this paper, gerrymandering the results, or do you think
for GPT deeper? On drugs, or oh, that would be a
GPT on brains
paper. No, I don't think that's the problem with this paper. I think this paper actually, in terms of presenting results, is fine, at least from my readings, but it's a bit of the what you were talking about of like the proxies of proxies. So it's a bit of relying on different EEG patterns, or like different amounts of interconnectivity, as they described it. So many brain areas activating instead of isolated areas, thinking that that is like more important for concepts like creativity and learning than they might necessarily be. But I also think there's like, I don't know, one of my spicier takes right now in my learning science department is that, yeah, we keep finding these studies that are like, you can cheat in it, or from observed experience also from teaching, like we keep finding that ChatGPT lets you write an essay without really thinking about the content. Well, like that's not necessarily a brain or a ChatGPT problem. It might just be that the essay's like kind of cooked. Like we might have to just find new assessment materials. And like, yeah, that sucks. Like essays are really handy for assessing mastery if you're in the brain only condition, which we largely had been, or in at least the search engine condition for a long time. But now that we're in the LLM condition, like as a society, like it's time to find a new measure, like time to find one that you can't game with AI. And part of what's annoying about that is it means you have to be really explicit about what your learning objectives are, that you could really easily say, okay, write an essay about topic, because if your learning objective is like deep understanding of topic, then you can't, in before LLMs, you couldn't easily produce a decent essay without that deep understanding. Now you can, so you need to find something that measures exactly deep understanding of topic without also being able to pick up like a false negative if somebody has use of LLM or some other superfluous skill. Like likewise, I mean, I think people who were kind of good at bullshitting and good at just like talking, you know, good verbal communicators, good bullshitters, were always better at essays than poor bullshitters. And that wasn't always measuring mastery of a topic, but it led to the essay being a bad measure for those sorts of people. I think that's exacerbated now, and I think we kind of need to face up to it. And I think that's not really part of this paper's discussion. So I think one thing that this paper demonstrated, or tried to make the claim anyway, so if you go from this LLM to brain condition, so if you came back for week four, if you had 3 weeks of practicing writing an essay with an LLM, then your essay without the LLM in week four kind of sucked, even though you were repeating the same topic. Like you had a harder time writing it now because you've practiced a different skill. So I think likewise, if you go through all of college, like able to write your, or all of high school or whatever, able to use AI to write essays, and then your exam is okay now, write an essay about this topic in an exam hall with no access to a computer, then it's, again, kind of assessing something outside of, at least for the courses I teach, outside of the learning objectives, that now you're assessing like written, like you're assessing writing skills rather than assessing topic mastery.
That was a little unclear in the paper. I wasn't sure if in session four, are you worse than you were at session one? Or are you worse than you were at session three?
So I tried to do this manually of like going back and forth between the LLM to brain condition and comparing them to week one brain. Like to see like, okay, is this like coming in fresh or did you gain some skills, at least like content level skills, if not like writing level skills? But it, I don't know. This, I think, was a problem with their measures that I tried to compare. In the interview, you got asked questions like, can you quote a line from your essay? Which, like, yeah, there was a big difference that LLM to brain people, after 3 weeks of writing with the LLM, week four writing with just brain, they were still not really able to quote parts of their own essay. Whereas the people who were always just writing off the top of their head could really reliably quote from their own essay. But I don't think that like matters much. Like, I don't think that's an important skill. And that's like one of the things that they focus on as like a postdoc interview measure. So I don't know. Why measure that? That's not like, that's not something I care if my students can do all that much.
There were also other kind of useless or obvious measures, like they said people who used LLM had brain activity that was closer to editing than it was to someone who was trying to remember things, which is quite obvious.
Yeah. It's almost as if they were editing instead of trying to remember things.
And said that brain regions associated with lower cognitive load. And it's just things that they had just said in the literature review already, where LLMs reduce cognitive load and induce editing instead of memory retrieval.
Which, like, as far as I'm concerned, I'm like, that sounds sick. Like, I can reduce my students' cognitive load and they can still produce, like, the material that I wanted them to produce. Awesome.
That's literally the point of LLMs, to do those things. But also, I don't know if I want my students using just memory for their assignments, but specifically academic ones.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not standing up there asking them, like, when was, you know, the Battle of Hastings or something. I mean, I don't teach English history, so it would be weird for me to ask that in a quantitative stats class. But, like, I don't know. Yeah, memory is not, like, it's low on the Bloom's taxonomy, right? That it's this, like, kind of a base level kind of foundational skill, but it's not this more kind of higher order creative skill of like using the knowledge.
And going back to your gerrymandering of results, the fourth session only had 18 participants compared to the 54 of the first three sessions. So there's the potential for the only people that returned were a specific type of people, or even, I don't want to say this, but maybe they just remove participants that
the like Occam's razor for me though is that wasn't it that each condition had 18 in the beginning, so then this ends up with a condition with 18 at the end of like session four, everyone, like if you combine them. I mean, that's a stupid reason to combine, in my opinion, or that's a stupid reason to get down to exactly 18. That shouldn't it then be 36 because you have two different conditions? But I don't know.
Oh, so you think that they cut it off so that they would only have 18 people in this condition?
I do, yeah. That was my like charitable and like simplest explanation reasoning, that I was like, okay, they kept doing this 18 thing as their like per group sample size, so I guess they wanted a group of 18 at the end to do something with. But again, I'll leave that to the reviewers and editors when this is at a journal to figure out.
Do you think it will be?
Yeah, the authors have been saying on LinkedIn that I think they're planning two different journal submissions, one focusing on the EEG results and one more with the NLP plus interview results, maybe.
Okay, today I wanted to basically tell you about why The Sims is a good metaphor for how we think and make decisions. Have you ever played The Sims?
Yeah, I have. I think I played like Sims 2 back when I was kid, and then I played a bit of Sims 4 in my adult life.
Do you want to describe in a few words how The Sims works for anyone who maybe grew up on Fortnite instead?
Yeah, I'm sure that's our demographic. I think I'm probably more talking to people who grew up on Missile Command. The Sims is a game where it's a simulation of life. So you can make a house and you make a character, and everyone inevitably makes like their own self and friends and family. And then you can either watch them autonomously interact, like they have to eat food and get a job and get money and go to the bathroom and go to sleep and stuff like that. Or you can kind of micromanage and say, okay, now cook food for yourself. Now sit at that table and eat it. Now go to your friend's house and say hello. Yeah, it's a life simulator game.
And the way you tell the Sims to do things is kind of from an outside point and click perspective. You're not directly controlling any of the avatars. You're basically saying, yeah, do this, then do this. You're kind of a manager, so to speak, of how they work.
You're playing God. No, you're like playing the like super ego of telling them what to do.
Well, funny you call it that, because I think it's a great metaphor for dual process theory. Have you ever heard of dual process theory? I guess.
No, I have not. we're currently writing a paper about it. I've been thinking fast and slow about it, Diego.
Great. So in dual process theory, it basically describes thinking in two ways. So you can think of one way being the player, you playing the game, deciding this sim needs to get up out of bed, go make food, do some reading to get their handyman skills up so they can fix this TV. Whereas the other type of thinking is the sim itself, who is always thinking about their bladder levels, as the sim calls it, their hunger levels, their fun levels, but also has to do the tasks themselves, has to do the social interactions themselves. They're the one in the driver's seat, basically. And there's so many different names for this, as you might know from our paper. People have been talking about dual process theories. There's over 4 or 50 names that I could find just in the literature. But I think in everyday life, people talk about it as well. Have you heard of Jonathan Haidt's riding the elephant metaphor?
I'm not sure if I've heard of this particular Jonathan Haidt metaphor.
I think it was on some book about happiness, but basically we're the rider of an elephant. Our conscious kind of decision-making planning is the rider, but the elephant is the unconscious automatic part, and that is doing most of the walking and deciding where to go, and we're kind of just on it for the ride. Maybe sometimes we can slightly turn the reins and make it go one way or another, but basically it's all elephant.
Okay, I know his other similar bestial metaphor, which is the the emotional dog and the rational tail, which is the opposite of how we normally think of it. Is it that the thing that's in control is our rational brain, and then there's a response that's emotional that follows our logical thinking? No, Haidt says that we're mostly just kind of emotional and reacting, and then the outcome of that, the ripple effect of all of our emotions and automatic reactions, is that little bit of logical control. So same idea, different animal. Thanks, Haidt.
Even Haidt can't, even he can't decide on his metaphors. He's making several theories to say the same thing. We also have things
the dual
like lizard
metaphor
brain
theory.
Tim Urban, do you know him? He has the instant gratification monkey.
No, is it a literal monkey or is this a metaphor?
It's a metaphor for procrastination. You have the instant gratification monkey when you're procrastinating that you're basically wrestling with, and he only goes away when the panic monster comes in and puts your stress into overdrive and basically scares the monkey away.
Okay, do any dual process theorists use non-animal metaphors to explain this?
I guess the player and the sim are non-animal.
You're breaking new ground.
We also have the idea of the angel and the devil, I think, can be considered similar to that.
Yeah.
The head and the heart, obviously ego, id, super ego, kind of three parts.
So I was wondering when we would get to our favorite podcast, Very Bad Wizards. At least that's like my main motivation for wanting to do a vaguely academic podcast with you. And as Dave Pizarro says when they talk about dual process theories, quoting some like friend from college or something, but why not three things instead of two? I kind of think Freud like beat us all to the punch on this one, but he said three things instead of two. Plato probably beat us all to the punch on this one.
I definitely think that Freud was one of the first ones to popularize it. Evans has been talking about it in terms of kind of the automatic part is an autonomous set of systems. It's not even one. It's parts of the brain that are deciding which task am I most suited to. So facial recognition would be one part of the brain. Broca's area, all those things we know about language would be other parts. So
editing an essay would be one part. Looking at a search engine exactly. result would be another. Yeah.
Recognizing Jennifer Aniston is another part.
Was it so for Phil it was recognizing Halle Berry, for you it was recognizing Jennifer Aniston. I don't think I have a this metaphor in neuroscience of like, did you know that you have one neuron that fires only when you recognize normally female celebrity who was popular in the 90s?
I'm pretty sure there was a paper, if not just articles online about it, that made it popular to think of Jennifer Aniston as having her own neuron.
I always actually heard it as Halle Berry.
Uh-oh. Maybe they had several examples depending on your...
You probably have many neurons.
...taste in women.
I haven't done much brain surgery, but there's probably a lot of them up there.
There's also some for Pokemon, apparently, if you grew up...
I definitely
Pokemon,
have a Vaporeon neuron.
Oh, God, don't. So regardless of if we have three or if we have two
neurons, you mean
three neurons. Yeah. The idea of having these two systems that are involved in thinking, there is the idea of a third system that kind of differentiates between which one goes at any one point and should we do it now or never. Freud's superego was more related to morality, and I'm not sure if morality is one way to differentiate between two and three, but the idea of having one type of automatic system being the sim and one type of planning system being the player has been reinvented 50 plus times across time. And the idea of the player is that as you're deciding what kind of job progression you want the sim to have, what kind of skills they need to develop to be able to fix their TV or paint to make money or whatever way you want to play the game, it's considering future outcomes and making plans without actually having to do any of the work and without having experienced any of it to know that this will happen if this happens. It's also costly and slow in the sense that people hate thinking for long periods of time. I know when I'm writing my thesis, I had to give up after a certain number of hours, regardless of the deadline, because it's really costly in terms of your mental resources to stay thinking all the time. And I'm pretty sure there is research that says it requires most of your working memory whenever you're doing that, if not working memory being one of the main ways that the player works. And that's different from the sim, because the sim requires those experiences to happen to it for it to learn and react to its needs, to its emotions. Like if it's too tired to go out and work, it's gonna wave its hands at you and complain and say, no, I need to go to bed now. So it's basically just id all the way. It's living in the moment and it's reacting to things that just happen.
Do you ever turn towards the player and wave and be like, I need to go to bed now, I give up? Or like turn towards the camera like Jim from The Office and kind of just be like, what's going on here?
I feel like we can't be the sim. We have to be the player. So
it's
in that
unfortunate,
sense,
yeah, that you look at the sim and you're like, oh, he's doing all the work and he's not suffering and I'm up here controlling it and I suffer for it. Wish I could be the sim.
So one of the ways that the sim actually learns is through something called operant conditioning. You may know it from behaviorism, from Skinner boxes, the pigeons, the rat experiments that you might have learned in psychology experiments. Do you feel like operant conditioning affects your life every day?
I mean, yeah, like it must, right? Like I'm probably not always aware of the ways that it does, but I'm 100% sure. Like I think I have an automatic reaction, for example, when I hear the sound my toaster makes when it finishes toasting, to turn my body towards the toaster and to reach for it. I have a toaster oven, not to brag, I'm doing pretty well, but to reach for the door and open it so my toast doesn't burn. Yeah, I think that's like a small way, but I think there's probably a billion things like that that I have all kinds of conditioning in my life for.
So yeah, you'd be right to think that as you move through your life, you're being affected by operant conditioning. We know that every single animal is affected and learns through positive and negative consequences, so it'd be hubris of us to think that we don't either. But if you haven't heard of operant conditioning, basically the very simple idea that if you do an action and you get rewarded at the end. You have some positive consequences. Let's say you open the fridge and you find a nice beer in there that you want to drink, then you're going to want to open the fridge and drink more beers. Whereas if you open the fridge and find a spider in there, then you'll quickly close the fridge and avoid going in there again. And that idea is a bit hard for some people to take into consideration. They think that maybe because of a big ego that they're not affected by small things that would affect how a dog behaves or a rat or a pigeon behaves. But if we think of the concept of the sim, operant conditioning is really the only way that the sim learns new ideas, how to behave. And we have a large database of studies for understanding how animals behave through conditioning. After behaviorism fell a few decades ago and people became more cognitively minded, the idea of using our knowledge from animal studies to see how people behave has kind of fallen out of fashion. But there is good stuff in there that, at least when I was doing my own research, came into play. The most interesting one I thought was temporal discounting, which is the idea of rewards that are further away are less enticing.
So I think TikTok is like the master of this. Have you... Maybe, I don't know, maybe this is not the universal experience, but I know multiple friends who, like, within the first month or two of making a TikTok account, had some random TikTok of theirs blow up and get like thousands of views, rather than like some, I don't know, YouTube, I would think, is like the ultimate, and like, it's a slow burn. You gotta be like grinding away for a long time before anyone's ever seeing your content, where the TikTok algorithm will make you get that big pop early on in the account's life.
Think it's making you as a strategy for keeping you on the platform?
Yeah, no, I very, very much think that. I think there's a handful of friends in my life who all had the same experience. Some who had TikToks that were kind of worthy of blowing up, or some who had multiple that were of equal value, or some who, like, why did that shit blow up? That's not funny or interesting at all.
Did you have one that blew up?
I never had a TikTok account.
I guess you're missing out on having that one moment of fame. Maybe
too
we'll
busy
save
playing
it for...
Fortnite. We can post clips of the podcast to TikTok and test this hypothesis.
I don't know how much you consider blowing up, but I definitely had the most views on a video that I've put online soon after joining TikTok. So maybe you're idea has some merit.
I'm more convinced of this than anything I learned during my PhD. I would take this one to the bank. TikTok does this.
So you think they're using temporal discounting in the sense that as soon as you enter the app or soon after joining TikTok or posting something early on in your TikTok experience, that they'll reward you really highly, so then you get that taste.
Yeah, I think this is the same technique that opioids use, that you're chasing the dragon after an initial high. But I think this is a temporal thing rather than a chemical thing, of course. I think this is that, yeah, you early on get this big reward, and then it teaches you that you get a reward for opening TikTok by over-teaching the lesson early on instead of making you have to grind it out and eventually get that reward later on in your TikToking career.
Wow, you're teaching the main thesis of my research before I even get there.
Oh, sorry. Don't worry, I didn't read your research, so I didn't know I was spoiling it.
But yeah, just like using all the good cocaine early on in your drug dealing with a customer, people seem to respond to rewards early on much better than later on. So there's the idea. Initially, people thought, okay, you might value money more now than later because of inflation, because maybe you don't trust that someone will give you that money later. There are several factors, and linearly as time goes on, the value of that money reduces depending on those factors. But in around 1975 with George Ainslie, we found out that it was way more hyperbolic than that, in the sense that you have a lot of value very close to the start, and that value drops precipitously as soon as a delay is introduced, and then it kind of plateaus to very low for a long time. So the idea would be, if I ask you, would you rather have $50 right now or $100 in 6 months, which one would you pick?
Take the 50 right now.
So glad you answered that way.
I know that's what you wanted me to say.
Well, I think I would too. I would prefer 50 euro right now than in 100 months. Mostly because it's nearly payday and I'm running out.
Yeah, I'd take the 50 right now, and then I'd get I'd join an online gambling website so I could get like an introduction 100 free euro bonus, and then I'd use that to join some gacha game where I'd buy a bunch of packs where I'd get a bunch of legendary characters early on. And I would keep parlaying this instant gratification and keep feeding the monkey.
Of course, and maybe get some Bitcoin in there.
I think the ship has sailed.
Oh no, my Bitcoin. So if I ask you later on, would you rather have $50 in 6 months or $100 in 12 months? Which one would you pick?
I'll take 100 in 12 months.
Exactly. And even though there's a 6 month gap in between the two, people consistently will pick the first option, the smaller option. In the first example, but the bigger option in the second example. And that kind of shows that the value between 6 months is way more biased towards right now.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think no matter what the science is, like, there's two time periods. There's right now and there's sometime in the future. And I care a lot more about right now, and sometime in the future is all the same time.
But one thing about right now was that in these instances, the 50 euro now or $50 now could take up to a minute, an hour. It wasn't very clear. Like if you say $50 tomorrow as opposed to 100 in 1 month, people still kind of picked the right now of tomorrow. So it wasn't very clear what right now meant for a while. But if we looked back at animal models, rats, pigeons, any of those, they would discount rewards in a matter of seconds, like 15, 20 seconds. You can think about trying to teach your dog a trick, like teaching them to sit. If you say sit and they do it and you wait 20 seconds to give them the reward, they're never going to associate the action with the reward. They're basically going to think, oh, thank you for randomly giving me this item. And this ability to associate the action with the reward is really important because you get things like superstitious pigeons. Have you heard of the superstitious pigeons?
No, maybe. This rings a bell, but I would like you to tell me more about them.
Pavlov's bell?
Yes. I'm salivating for details.
It was when pigeons were given rewards randomly. In one of those Skinner boxes, they would just drop food every few seconds with no rhyme or reason. And the pigeons would go eat the food, then get bored, start walking around. And at whatever point the food did come, whatever activity they were doing right there and then, they started to think was the way to get more food. So let's say they were doing a lap of the Skinner box. They would get the food, start doing a lap. The food would appear. They would go and eat it, think, okay, I need to do more laps. And because they were just constantly doing laps, then the food would always appear when they were doing laps. So they created the superstition that doing laps of the cage is what food.
Okay, now I need to hit you with like three personal anecdotes that I'll try to keep very short because we're going on. One, I grew up in Atlantic City, New Jersey, which is like casino capital of the East Coast. So that's exactly how gambling addicts act, where they're like, this machine always hits on Tuesdays, or oh, that machine's hot right now because I just played those three machines. So yeah, these superstitions based on whatever random bullshit you were doing before you got a random reward definitely also works on humans. I've observed it. Number two, my sister is a veterinarian now, but when she was an undergrad, she was a psychology major and she worked in the rat alcohol lab. And they did these same sorts of behavioral economics studies of like what kinds of rewards and what kinds of delays and whatnot will rats put up with to get alcohol. And the answer was basically anything that gets me alcohol right now, that's my choice.
Sounds like me.
Yeah, exactly. They could have just asked you. And then when you were telling all about these temporal discounting studies, I was like, man, this is so familiar. I wonder if you cite Chris Kirby at all. Then I was looking at your citations and you cite Chris Kirby extensively. He was my undergraduate advisor. He like taught me how to do statistics. I still use some of his teaching materials to teach statistics. So it's really nice seeing him in your references. I did not know this one level of separation.
Yeah, I reference him. At least three of his papers. He's big into this right now.
Kind of work. Big into this right now. I see one of his papers, 1995, Chris Kirby.
Well, he was big into it when it was relevant.
Yeah, no, if you ever want to talk to him, like I email him regularly. I'm friends with him.
Well, one of the things that I think that he missed that people have done since, not to disparage.
He'll probably, whatever you're about to say, he would agree. He's like the most like low ego scientist. Honestly, one of the only like low ego scientists I've ever met.
Oh, thanks.
What? You're one of the highest ego scientists I've ever met.
Well, if you're using Freud's ego interpretation, then...
Sorry, you're one of the highest id scientists I've ever met.
God damn it. So one of the ideas was that Kirby was finding these results where people were discounting in terms of months, but animal studies were discounting in terms of seconds. And then monkeys, at least we could get up to an hour. But the main idea was that the animals actually had to experience the delay. They actually did the tasks. Where Kirby's work was, imagine you would get...
No. Kirby was very adamant that he paid his participants. He would track down people 6 months later and give you the 25 cents that you won in your study.
Yeah, but in the moment...
Sure, yeah, you did. You didn't have to wait. You had to make the decision now, and then you had to do the waiting. You didn't have to wait before making the decision.
Exactly. So the idea was, you're in the experiment hall, you're getting your food reinforcers or whatever it is, and then you have to wait the 16 seconds for the next one. So not only are you giving away the future outcome by taking the one right now, but you're also not having to... think of the opportunity costs of having to wait there and
there. Yeah, the animals literally have to do the marshmallow test, that the other option is right there in front of them if they are going to delay gratification.
Exactly. So when we're thinking about the sim and the player who's considering rewards can think of things in terms of months, years.
Hold on, sorry. the Kirby defender has logged back on. Wasn't his alternative always right now versus in the future? So I guess you don't have to continuously make the decision. You can't, if it was like $50 in 6 months or $10 right now, you couldn't come back in 2 months and be like, yeah, I'll take the $10. Yeah. Okay, never mind. The Kirby defender has logged back off.
Well, the problem isn't that temporal discounting affects one and not the other. I'm pretty sure temporal discounting affects the player and the sim. Yeah. I think the idea is that the player is affected less in terms that they can consider, as I said, something between 6 months and 18 months away and make a decision about that, where the sim only can think in terms of now and the next 20 seconds and the next 40 seconds. So that's one way if you're trying to... if you have any decision where you're having conflicts between the player and the sim, is to know that the sim needs things immediately, needs interaction, needs experience right now. And one of the ways to do that is called a conditioned reinforcer, which is basically the idea that if something predicts a reward, eventually that prediction item, that cue, becomes rewarding by itself. So if you're thinking of maybe you're a lion in the savannah and you only see grass as far as the eye can see, and you're really thirsty and you start walking around and you see a tree and you go towards that tree and then you find water and start drinking. The next time that you're walking towards around the savannah, seeing the tree will tell you, oh, that's where the water was. And the tree itself becomes a rewarding cue.
Okay, same as the superstitious pigeons.
In a sense, you're attaching value to things that predict a cue. The superstitious pigeons weren't correct, but they believed that it predicted a cue.
Yeah.
Whereas this is actually... predicting it. And you can have the same thing with fear responses. So you would have learned in your psychology degree about Little Albert.
Certainly. Chris Kirby was teaching me that shit.
Little Albert basically was scared by loud noises. Every time a white bunny that was put in front of him, or was it just a white bunny teddy bear?
I think there was a real white bunny.
So he was given this white bunny, loud noises were kind of played behind him.
Bang a pipe, right? I thought yeah, he banged a pipe or dropped a pipe.
Yeah, it was something loud and obnoxious anyway. And that made the baby start crying. And then repeated exposure to the bunny and the loud noises made the baby, Little Albert, really afraid of the bunny. Every time he saw the bunny, he remembered the loud noise. He remembered him crying and would be afraid of the bunny. And this also transferred to things like white pieces of fluff, cotton, any other things that kind of looked like the cue of bunny, also had that transfer. So it's this idea where you can attach the emotional, motivational influence of one item, a direct reward or punishment, to another item. And that's the general idea around money, that we use money so many times to buy things that we find massively rewarding, that now money itself becomes massively rewarding because of that.
So shit. That actually was like a nice twist at the end that I didn't see coming. I was going to say on the Little Albert experiment that this was also like the superstitious pigeons, in that he shouldn't have feared white things. He should have feared 1950s psychology professors.
Well, I've heard about the things that those professors did with their own children.
Yeah, so that would have been the more logical thing to fear, bro. You had it all wrong, you stupid baby.
So one of the things I think about is, if we're thinking about creating a game like The Sims, when they're making their own decisions, if you leave them to their own autonomous influences, they will go around, depending on the setting, and do whatever they want.
Yeah, they'll just, like, eat and piss, but they won't try to get mega rich.
Yes, unfortunately. So the idea is, there must be something underneath that assigns values, unless they're working randomly, which I doubt it, but assigns values to certain things based on their own needs. So if their hunger level is low, then the fridge will have a value of 80%, let's say. And if their bladder levels are high, then the toilet will only have a motivational value of like minus 20%.
If you've installed the Ozempic mod, then the fridge has a lower intrinsic value.
I think so, yes. Yeah. So this idea of each queue having its own value is a way that the sim makes its choices around the world. And these values change over time, and they also change depending on your choices. So if you have three choices in front of you, and one of them is obviously better than the others, that will also change that value. So it's kind of environment dependent. And because each of these items has a value and they can act as their own reinforcer, then they can be used to reinforce other things that predict them. So if you have a three action chain of things you need someone to do, or let's say more simply, if you want to teach your dog to do a complex behavior that requires three actions, you can slowly scaffold the sequence together by creating condition reinforcers one after the other. So first you get them to do the last part of the action. Let's say you want them to do a trick where they sit, lie down, and then they roll over. So first you'd have them roll over, you'd reinforce that behavior, then you would have them lie down first, teach them how to get from lie down to roll over. So then lie down is predictive of roll over. Those would connect together, and then you do that with sitting and all the way, and you scaffold this action sequence using each last action as the reinforcer for the previous action. And that's something called chunking, where you can create stimulus response chains, as they're called, that become this one massive chunk that once it's learned, your sim is just reacting to the next cue. So they know, if this cue happens, I do this action, I get to the next cue, which is the reward, and so on until you get to the very end.
And you've definitely met well-trained dogs like that, where as soon as the dog sits, they start trying to shake your hand, even if you did not ask them to shake your hand.
Yeah, because usually people will do tricks all
at
once.
Yeah, it's like sit, give paw up. Yeah, they do the whole chunk.
Yeah, so dogs tend to chunk things like that as well. And one of the things about chunking is that it's the main way that control moves from the player to the sim. Because if you have these actions that have very dictated responses that you need to do every time, and they always reward you, then there's no point in you putting in mental effort, because the sequence of events is right there. And that's how your habitual system builds, so that you can offload your thinking to that next thing. So if you're learning to drive at the start, it's all player controlled. You're moving your arms almost randomly at that stage, trying to get the car to work. But eventually, once you do it over and over again, then you offload that thinking to the sim part, and then you can start thinking about more interesting things like, will I get home in time to catch Love Island or something like that?
I'm glad I wasn't around when you were first learning to drive. I was around, but I was not on the road when you were first learning to drive and moving your arms almost at random.
Well, I didn't want to say it, but that is how I feel my partner drives even after they...
We're over an hour in. There's no way your partner's still listening.
But one interesting thing about that is that once a chunk is created, it's no longer sensitive to devaluation. And what I mean by that is, if you're doing something and you get a reward at the end, if you've learned that chunk and you see the first item on that chunk and you start going, even if that reward at the end is no longer interesting for you, you'll still go through the whole action sequence. So let's say you're teaching a pigeon an action sequence, and at the end they get food. Even if you go off and give that pigeon so much food that it's completely satiated, it's no longer hungry, if it sees the first action on that chain, if it starts it, it will get to the end, regardless of how hungry it is, regardless of the fact that they don't really want the food at the end and they don't even eat the food at the end, they will continue to do that. So it's no longer sensitive to devaluation, which is interesting when you're trying to think about actions that you do almost automatically, even though you no longer remember why you did them in the first place or why you wanted the reward at the end. Do you have anything that's kind of like that?
I'm trying to think in my own life, but I actually was trying to think also. I had this insight. I went to a conference recently and I was like, man, these people are all presenting basically some statistically significant result at the end of a paper that almost has nothing to do with what the paper was about, but then they needed some quantitative result, and that's like what makes it real science. And I was having this insight that these people are doing quantitative analysis at the end of their paper purely out of superstition, that it's like, okay, I did my scientific study, and then as long as I say P is less than 0.05 at the end, I get my pat on the head.
Yeah, they have their analysis chunk, and as soon as they're writing a paper, they go into OR and just start putting variables together.
Yeah, start gerrymandering the data so that they can get to that P equals 0.05, because they know that that's the last chain in the sequence, and then work backwards from there. Even if you're satiated, even if you're already a tenured professor.
An interesting thing about that is reward devaluation, as I said, doesn't stop it, but punishment, direct immediate punishment, any time in that sequence will stop it. So
if Data Colada comes for your ass, then it's all over.
Exactly. And I found that with myself. I for a long time, I think maybe I have some attention deficit tendencies. I don't want to pull at that string, but for a long time, I would bite my nails and the skin around my nails whenever I was bored or I don't know, needed some stimulation of any sort. And for a long time, I would put like gloves on. I would think about like things that I shouldn't be, or why I don't want to do that. Every time I went, the hand came to my mouth, I'd think, no, that is not something that is valuable to me, to have fingers that are all bit up. And none of these things were working. And then as soon as I got that bitter nail polish you can get for people who bite their nails.
Yeah, I remember you embarking on that journey.
As soon as the finger hit my mouth and I got that immediate bitterness, like that habit sequence was just breaking so quickly. By the second day, I think by the second hour, actually, the hand wasn't coming to my mouth at all, which is really good. But my mind is feisty and adaptable. And now I pick at my fingers with my other nails.
I thought you were going to say now yes. You just drink the nail polish straight from the bottle.
my friend's brother was like that. He so wanted to bite his nails that he learned to like the nail polish and then started licking it off his nail.
Find him at the GameStop licking the back of the Nintendo Switch cartridges.
Exactly. I guess he conditioned, reinforced the nail polish to beat the inherent ickiness of it, which is basically what we do with like coffee and beer.
Oh yeah.
We associate positive interactions with it and basically beat out the natural negative stimulus.
It also helps that they have like habit forming drugs like caffeine and alcohol in them. Like not so many people get a non-alcoholic beer addiction without first having a beer addiction.
That's true. And I think that beer addiction, or at least the drunkenness, can be a little placebo, because I know whenever I'm drinking non-alcoholic beer, I still feel a little.
Decaf coffee wakes you up for sure.
So another part of that is we talked about having values for each of these actions. So if you're the sim and you're deciding amongst options, you basically have these point values across all your options. And that's related to Thorndike's associative cybernetic model, which basically says the higher the value, the more motivating it is. And so if you want to make something as motivating as possible, just get that value as high as possible, or get the value of everything else around it as low. And this made me think of the idea that you spoiled everyone already, that if temporary discounting is a thing and if chunking is a thing, if you're deciding amongst your options of action sequences and you're just going off that value until the chunk builds is going to be mostly at the end. But if we come in and reward a person really early as they decide to go down a route, that really high reward at the start will make that first action in the sequence really valuable. and then people will want to start that sequence much more than other sequences.
So QED, the devs of TikTok, have read Thorndike and Kirby.
Well, it's not only the devs of TikTok. If you download any mobile game, they now all have a login bonus. Because they're trying to get you to come back every day.
Diego, when I first met you, when you were 2 years into your PhD, and I was just starting mine, and you did a presentation about your study, and I think my first question was like, so you're going to go work for one of the gambling companies, or Facebook, or Duolingo? And you were like, what? No. And I did not believe you at all. And now I'm shocked that you don't work for them, because I think you would have been making big money, because literally every app does exactly what you're an expert in.
But the fact that I know about all these techniques means that I absolutely hate every mobile game. And every mobile game has these techniques as well. And I just can't stand any of them. As soon as I see them, I'm like, I know what you're doing. And it's not working. So no mobile gaming for me, except Balatro.
I feel like that one's pretty chill, right? Yeah, like it's not trying to do all that gimmicky stuff.
So basically, that's the idea. If we want people to do a sequence, we reward them very early. We know that they'll continue the sequence until the end because they're kind of locked into the next stimulus chain. We maximize the first queue, and that's how we get them to go and do that. So that's what my research did, and I don't need to explain all the findings from that. So, but basically, if you give people money just as they make a decision or points on a leaderboard, they're more likely to make that decision than if you gave them points or money later. And I think that's really interesting as a finding in terms of when we're thinking about how we can control our sim self whenever we're trying to make decisions.
Yeah, I think this is super applicable. I think we've already like connected it to so many things. So really, really cool stuff. I think that's the rare time I'm going to give you a genuine compliment about your research. But I think you do research that's actually like interesting, relevant, probably not overstated, probably not overly importance hacking. Good stuff. Keep on doing that. Don't go work for DraftKings or whatever.
Do you have any one thing that you think, oh, I've really been struggling to get my sim under control for this thing?
Ah, God, I have so many things. I think the classic for any academic is writing. Like, I just trying to make yourself sit down and actually write something.
Yeah, so that would be under the category of things that have delayed outcomes. So the delayed outcome is that you want to have this paper written, and that will be a big reward for you.
Yeah.
But also in the category of actions that are daunting. So the act itself is really hard. So the idea there is the action is difficult. So the value associated with that decision is already going to be in the negative. So whenever you're thinking about, I want to start writing, that emotional valence is already against you.
So I should go into Google Scholar, open DevTools, change my H index to like 600, and then get that immediate boost of dopamine, and then I'll write?
You're joking, but that is one way to do it.
You're joking, but that's exactly how I write.
You make the daunting task less daunting. There's two ways to do it. So you can add rewards to the decision itself so that you try and counteract that. Or, because the daunting part is the tiredness you get from long periods of writing.
Yeah.
You can break it into actions.
What are you, my PhD supervisor now? Write a little bit each day.
Basically,
he learned that shit from you. One of the things that you conditioned him to tell me to do that.
What works for me is that I think, okay, I don't want to write, but I'm okay with sitting at the computer and turning it on. And then you start slowly building it that way.
That's exactly how I wrote my thesis.
Kimmy Schmidt method. I don't know if you've seen Kimmy Schmidt, where she's stuck underground and she has to keep turning a lever basically forever. And the way she keeps doing it is saying, I can do it for another 10 seconds. 10 seconds isn't so bad. And she does it for years and years at a time.
One must imagine Kimmy Schmidt to be happy. You wouldn't get that. You refuse to read philosophy.
Okay. Well, that's it. That's my takeaway.
Awesome. Yeah, good stuff. Thanks for the practical insight at the end. Yeah, good podcasting. All right. Well, I'm Justin Edwards, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oulu.
I'm Diego Garialde. I'm a assistant professor at the University College Dublin.
The
one and only.
not the University of Dublin. That's Trinity.
Okay. I look forward to going and editing this to a nice 40 minutes.
Yeah. Feel free to take out any of my rambles. I know I had some long stretches of yapping.
Long stretches of yapping. That should be your podcast name. I'll see you next time.